But first, we mark an important anniversary. For once, we all saw it. We couldn't look away. A handcuffed human being face down on pavement, pleading for his life while a police officer slowly killed him. George Floyd's murder 2 years ago today marked a turning point for some, a thunderclap, at least temporarily, that forced this nation to reckon with its racist history, systemic violence against Black people, and the systems that continue to oppress people of color today. We're connecting today with local Black leaders in the faith community, politics, and activism to share their perspectives on the change or lack thereof since the summer of 2020. We'll get to that in just a moment. But first, the calls for change were loud in the streets during that summer. They were followed by the work to transform that political will into policy. And how have our laws governing policing in Washington state changed post-George Floyd? Reporter Amy Radel is here to talk with me now about that. She covers politics and the courts for KUOW. Hi, Amy. Thanks for being here.
Hi. Good morning.
So what have the main changes to police use of force laws in Washington been, as well as here in Seattle, over the past couple of years?
Well, I feel like the wave that we saw cresting around the country 2 years ago really started reaching Washington a few years earlier. Voters passed Initiative 940, and that created a new standard to charge police officers with misuse of deadly force. So that law passed, but the people working on police accountability had always been this kind of small core group. And I think that they got a huge lift from the protests. You know, they had legislators' attention in a new way last spring, and they helped pass a dozen new laws. Some of them are first in the nation efforts. We're going to have a database of all serious use of force incidents by police in the next few years. The governor has formed an Office of Independent Investigations, and that's going to have civilian teams that can investigate police deadly force incidents. Legislators also passed laws to require de-escalation, to ban neck restraints by police. And then we actually saw our attorney general file murder charges against Tacoma police officers in the death of Manuel Ellis. And that was because the local process to investigate his death was seen as so flawed. So I'm not sure if any of those things would have happened without the protests that were sparked by George Floyd's murder 2 years ago.
Earlier this year, Governor Inslee signed legislation to tweak some of those new laws. Amy, what happened?
Yeah, we revisited some of those. I think with rising crime and some time having passed since the protests, the voices of law enforcement were heard more by legislators this past spring. Some of the changes were seen as just fixes. They weren't controversial. They clarified that we do want police to take people into custody at crisis calls, and we do want police to use the less lethal projectiles. So that was just a clarification. The major change was to once again allow police to use force to detain someone if they have reasonable suspicion that the person was involved in a crime. The year before, the legislature tried to ban those stops unless police basically had enough evidence to arrest someone. But public opinion and feedback from police was that it was allowing people to flee from questioning, and it was just too much of a hindrance for law enforcement. So I think that's where we saw the biggest rollback of something that protesters had called for the year before, and the police accountability groups were disappointed by that.
And reform is one thing, but there are plenty of voices who say we're past that. Has the police abolition movement seen any successes recently?
I think the abolition movement is really having its biggest success in terms of how we treat young people who are at risk of criminal involvement. Seattle and King County are funding a whole new network of community groups that are sending people to the scenes of gun violence. They're trying to address the needs of the young people and their families. Our prosecutors are working with groups like Choose 180 and Community Passageways on restorative justice models so that young people don't get a criminal record, which we know can lead to so much harm later on. So those are ways that it's being taken out into the community away from the courts. And then you have examples like Chief Diaz has instructed Seattle police officers to no longer make certain kinds of traffic stops, you know, for expired tabs and things like that. So we're not abolishing our police force by any means, but people are trying to narrow the scope of police and court involvement for people.
Trying to lessen the contact between the community and law enforcement. How have police unions and law enforcement leadership influenced this process over the years, Amy? They certainly want their voices to be heard.
Yeah, and I think, you know, they were maybe a little more cut out of the process in 2021. There was just so much passion for getting those new laws passed. I think they, you know, now have come back to advocating more at the legislature and at their local levels. I think in Seattle, they're met with a fair amount of scrutiny and pushback. You can hear in the public comment periods when we discuss law enforcement issues. I think that's less so in surrounding cities. And we've kind of seen some shades of difference within law enforcement. You know, like we have the Fraternal Order of Police in Washington. That group got accolades from some of the accountability folks for being very open to some of the new legislation that we've passed. And I do see the people who have had loved ones killed by police, they used to be, you know, advocating kind of from the outside, and now they are actually becoming respected voices and members of like our main state agency, the Criminal Justice Training Commission that trains police and says who can work as a police officer in Washington. Those family members, several of them are now on that commission. It's majority civilian, and they seem to have really collaborative relationships with the members of law enforcement on that board. So I don't think it's always as divisive as, you know, observers might expect.
What issues are you following, Amy Radel, as the efforts to change policing move forward in Washington State and in Seattle?
I'm interested in watching which police departments, which agencies show that they heard what the protesters were calling for in 2020. I see agencies that seem really excited to look at how to recruit new officers from different walks of life, to be more transparent, to be thoughtful in how they address people in crisis and those kinds of calls. And then I see some agencies that don't seem like they're, you know, very responsive on some of this, or that's not their main interest. And then this isn't policing exactly, but, you know, King County is working to end youth detention completely by the year 2025. I think the form that this will take for young people is still being determined. But I hear a lot of excitement from reformers about how much King County has already reduced the number of youth in detention. And I think if we can end that, it'll be another first in the nation policy. And I think it's another focus that the protests really highlighted and intensified.
Amy Radel covers politics in the courts for KUOW. Thanks for being here, Amy.
Yeah, you're welcome.
And joining me now is Nikita Oliver. They're a Seattle-based community organizer, artist, abolitionist, and attorney. And they ran for city council last year. They're also a founding member of the Seattle People's Party. Also here is Representative Kirsten Harris-Talley of the 37th District in the State House, including Beacon Hill, the Rainier Valley, and part of Renton. And Dr. Patricia Hunter, pastor for outreach and education at Seattle's First Baptist Church, interim pastor for worship at Mount Zion Baptist Church, and commissioner with the Seattle Community Police Commission. And I thank all of you for making the time to be with me today. First off, I just want to open the floor. Nikita, let's start with you. This is obviously a day when grief is weighing heavy on our hearts. The news out of Uvalde just comes in the wake of what happened in Buffalo. How are you processing what's going on? What's on your mind?
Yeah, thanks for having me today. You know, honestly, I'm in a place of a lot of grief and a lot of pain. In a lot of ways, I think our society sees these devastations and just keeps moving. We just keep working. We don't really ever stop to do the hard work of transforming the systems that are making the massacres we've experienced as of late possible. And when I think about being, again, at this anniversary of the murder of George Floyd, what really comes to mind for me is how we are so committed to reforms that we fail to actually get to root causes. And we live in a place where the material conditions that communities are experiencing are really driving the violence that we see occurring. And we need to get to a place where we are willing to do the things that transform society and transform communities so that we don't have to keep moving through these devastating moments.
Dr. Hunter, as a faith leader, what are the words that you're going to be offering your parishioners, folks who are seeking comfort right now? How can we find solace in the middle of all of this?
Well, I think first it's really important to acknowledge that that people are really hurting, mm-hmm. and to let folk know that the rage and the anger is understandable, and that it's important not to deny how painful this time really is. And as a faith community, we have one another, and so that we can share the pain, that we can lean into our faith in God and in one another to try and get through this incredibly painful time. And it feels like we never heal from the last tragedy before another one is compounding the last pain and hurt. And so after a while, it almost just feels unbearable. So yeah. But we have each other. Yeah.
Thank you for that. And Representative Kirsten Harris-Talley, what's on your mind today as we're all really dealing with so much, but at the same time, we are trying to mark an anniversary of such importance to the country?
I am sitting with so much of what has already been named, which is a collective grief. I'm thinking about an arc of history, 400 over four centuries of the work of abolition to end slavery and oppression and what that still looks like in our communities. I have been reflecting a lot about what the start of protests looked like this time 2 years ago. There was this calm and quiet that came with the pandemic, something that people had hoped at this point of 2020 was going to be an acute crisis. We now know in hindsight, we are still experiencing the crisis of that pandemic. And of course, the backdrop of that was the pandemic of racism and police violence, state violence. The protests and what George Floyd's death surfaced was that when collectively we all paid attention, because there was this moment with the pandemic forcing us all to stop and pause, which we do not often do. And we all witnessed the grotesque way in which he lost his life in just over 8 minutes. And people took to action. And that action is what will sustain us. It is what has always sustained us. And so, as always, I turn to my neighbors and community and look to where folks can be held and take action together. So those are the things I'm reflecting on today.
Nikita Oliver, there have been substantive gains in the movement to reimagine public safety, in the movement to change policing, but obviously huge areas where you and other abolitionists would point that to the fact that we're falling short. Can you lift up some of those gains here and then also highlight the areas in which you think we can move forward?
Yeah, I actually personally don't think that we have made significant gains. I think that we have made reforms, and I don't think we've actually reimagined public safety at all. We have reformed the public safety system of relying on police and courts and reactionary measures, and have actually missed what the movement for abolition is saying, which is the deeper changes that address the material conditions that drive inequity, that drive safety issues. I mean, we are living in a city that has, in a terrifying way, ramped up sweeps of people. We criminalize poverty. We police poverty. And we do so with the lens of racism and disability or ableism and sexism and transphobia overlaying it. And so what I would actually say is, we need to drastically change the way that we think about how we generate safety in communities, how we meet basic needs, how we ensure that people have access to housing as a human right. We say it, but we don't do it. How we make sure that people have access to clean water and gender-affirming full-spectrum healthcare. These are actually the things that would ensure more safety for everyone. And while across the country we are hearing people say, you all defunded the police and that's why we're seeing upticks in violence. It's statistically untrue. The police, most police departments have not experienced a substantial defunding. And what I find more concerning is we have not seen real substantial investments in new public safety and public health models and infrastructures that transform the way that we respond to harm and that we heal harm. Mm-hmm. And so I actually think that is the work that we have to do. We have to, as policymakers, as advocates, as activists, find ways to move beyond reforms, reforms that are not new, that have been recommended since the 1880s, and actually move to a different place of addressing material conditions. And I say that because George Floyd was criminalized for an alleged counterfeit $20 bill. We police poverty partially that he was murdered over an alleged counterfeit $20 bill. And that is something as a society we have to really grapple with and then start doing the work to treat Black folks, to treat poor folks, to treat folks without access to housing in a much more humane way and start building real access into those things that we know stabilize folks, connect communities, and ultimately build safety for everyone.
Yeah, and Representative Harris Talley, Nikita Oliver highlighted something that I've noticed as well, is people believe something about the defunding, quote unquote, of police departments that's simply not true. A lot of folks still have in their mind that, you know, Seattle went through with these promises that were early on in the protest movement to defund 50% of the police department, which did not happen. And a lot of the cuts that we even saw in 2022 were from unfilled police positions. Now, I think that there is a serious messaging issue where folks are not receiving, you know, the full scope of actually what's happened with complicated public funding issues, things that are really hard to translate. How do you think about communicating with the public about those issues, you know, as a legislator and then, you know, going forward in your next chapter?
Yeah, so I want to say I wholly agree with Nikita that even in the realm of reform, we have made very little progress in reform. And I say that having served in a legislature that in 2021 passed the largest number of police reform bills that any given state did. But as noted in the piece before this panel, we also saw rollbacks, for instance, the probable cause rollback in 2022. So a state legislature that was willing to not even let the laws that we had passed be on the books and see the results of those reforms. So that has to be noted that if we're going to make policy changes, we have to stick by those changes. And structurally, there are a number of changes upstream that we are still not investing in at the levels that we need to. To your point about funding, to be clear, the city of Seattle nor the state of Washington neither have cut in any large measure the actual amount of dollars that are spent in policing. And to also be clear, what I am continuing to hear from constituents is when they contact the police, they respond after awful traumatic things have happened. They are not something that responds to that moment that could avert crisis and moments of care, which is actually what people are asking for. So rethinking our first response systems, I see promise in behavioral health infrastructure and other investments. But to the point also that you've made, right, we have a new city governance in place. We have a new city attorney. It's very clear that punitive 1980s-esque policy is coming back. We're seeing that already. The negotiations that will happen with our local police department, all of those considerations of the local conversations happening this year, we'll see what changes we made on the books at the state level really have any promise of making any instrumental change in people's everyday lives. And that's ultimately what I want to see happen. You do not want to see the senseless death of George Floyd not come to huge instrumental structural change, which is why we have to continue to push at the local level and the state level and the federal level for the recognition and changes that our communities have deserved for generations.
Dr. Patricia Hunter with the First Baptist Church in Seattle, also Mount Zion Baptist Church, you're a commissioner with the Seattle Community Police Commission. What do you want people to know about the work of that commission? And also, how can people get involved? I know you hold regular engagement meetings.
Right. We do. And I guess I also want to say that the Black community, the communities of color in Seattle, we're not a monolith, though, that there is great diversity. And not everyone in that community is a defund the police person. I was not. I am not. I want the police to be funded in a way that they can safely protect the residents of Seattle. I also want just policing, unbiased policing, communities at risk to be able to call SPD and know that they will be treated with respect and dignity like we deserve to be treated. Because of George Floyd and other deaths by sworn officers across the country, I chose to be a part of the Seattle Community Police Commission. I needed to do something. And so chose to work with the commission and try to do my part for to hold police accountable. We do have meetings twice a month. We do encourage those who want to share with us what's going on in their lives and their experiences to come to our meetings. They have been on Zoom in the past, but moving forward for our next meeting, it will be an in-person meeting, but there will be opportunities to phone in and to have community comments. We also have community engagement meetings once a month that we hear from the community. Generally, I believe they're held on the second Tuesday of each month in the night, so that those who are working can come. So we do our best to try and be present in community and listen to what community has to say.
And Doctor, do you feel that there are voices that are being heard from the commission? I mean, what types of work are you doing on the commission in order to shape the future of policing in Seattle?
Yeah, well, the Office of Police Accountability, works with those cases that are of misconduct that are charged with, that the police are charged with. And right now we are reviewing some of those findings from the Office of Police Accountability, providing support for the findings that we think were legitimate, and as well as those areas where we feel that something different needed to be done, sharing our input as a police commission, as community, where we feel that the discipline was insufficient, whether it was a 20-day suspension when somebody was killed. One of the things that we're also encouraging is to have more crisis intervention teams. When someone calls in a mental health crisis, an officer may not be the best person to go immediately and to take charge of the situation. It may be a mental health team that can be much more effective than someone with a badge and a gun. But there's not a whole lot of those teams available. And so encouraging funding for those kinds of teams so those in a mental health crisis can find the support that they need. So those are the kinds of support that we're advocating for on the Community Police Commission.
Representative Harris Talley, you wrote in the South Seattle Emerald about why you decided not to run for re-election. And in part, you shared some of your frustrations with pursuing change in the legislature. I wonder if you can talk to me about, we, you know, have heard Nikita Oliver speak about abolition and Dr. Patricia Hunter speak about her belief that there are ways to improve the system within the existing structure of police. I wonder if you can speak about what your perspective is moving forward about where real change is possible and whether it's possible within systems that we have.
Yes, and I, the very first place I put my concentration, I had the opportunity to be vice chair of the Children, Youth, and Families Committee at the state level. This committee, anything that impacts youth that is not part of our education committee comes through that committee, including considerations for juvenile justice. Having myself as an abolitionist been part of the No New Youth Jail work at the city and county level here in Seattle, really the first thing I looked at was what is happening with jailing youth in our state. What I found out immediately is we don't know what's happening. We don't ask base questions about where youth are being incarcerated, for how long. None of that is being reconciled at the state level. So our office immediately took to that to task. One thing I'm looking very closely at the county level, and neighbors need to continue to look at, particularly when we're thinking about moving to alternatives to caging youth, is that we have too many systems that are looking at not having brick and mortar caging, but are still looking at electronic monitoring incarceration, which is still incarceration happening within our communities. So being really aware of how these systems are malleable and change, you know, slavery has not looked the same for four centuries, and our policing systems are going to continue to adapt to hide the very heinous things that happen within them. So that's a place I want us to continue to keep attention. Our young people are being very deeply traumatized in these systems when we could be utilizing government resources to really be helping youth get to where they need to be to have care. And as they grow up, know that they have everything they need to thrive. So those are places I see a lot of promise and work. Nikita Oliver's organization, their organization, Creative Justice, Choose 180, Community Passageways, and others are really the community leaders I turn to when those conversations are happening. And I think the work of the police commission and other spaces where neighbors are coming together for work is where I will continue to be doing my work in activism.
Nikita Oliver, I want to just first give you a time to reflect on what has been said already. Go ahead with that first. And then I have a question, you know, kind of broadly about the way that media interacts with the community. But first, what's your reaction to what you've heard from Representative Kirsten Harris-Talley and Dr. Patricia Hunter?
Yeah, I absolutely want to undergird that Black community is not a monolith. I think that's really important to acknowledge, as Dr. Hunter said. And similar to Representative Harris-Talley, you know, have to give a lot of acknowledgement to movements like the No New Youth Jail movement, the Block the Bunker campaign to stop the building of a new jail up in North Seattle maybe 5 or 8 years ago, for pushing us as a region to think differently about how we generate safety in communities, how we treat young people, and what does restorative justice really look like, rather than punitive pursuits that actually don't generate safety. I think what is hard to grapple with in our city is we are seeing things like Operation New Day. We are seeing the city attorney's office deny folks who are in what's called the true blood population access to community court. We are seeing a uptick in sweeps, but we are not seeing increased investment in housing or support. And while we do have a mental health care system statewide that is getting ramped up in our city, we don't have adequate mental health care access for folks. And so when we talk about building more teams who can respond to crises in a way that is appropriate, that will mean taking dollars away from a $410 million invested Seattle Police Department. And our city council just this week voted to actually give the police more money for things like recruitment and hiring. And so I'm actually a bit disturbed by the way that our city has moved, because we haven't made considerable investments in the things that we know actually work to keep people out of the school to prison pipeline, out of the court to cage pipeline, out of needing to access these reactionary crisis tools that are also not well equipped to meet needs. I'm not seeing city council members bring emergency investments for things like addressing the housing crisis, knowing that thousands of people are on the verge of eviction because of what has happened during the pandemic. So my hope moving forward, and I believe that hope is a discipline. It's not some touchy-feely thing. It is being committed to a vision of change that we will actually see our city council, our executive office, invest more resources in the preventative measures that keep people from ever reaching these crisis points.
I just, while we close here, want to be honest that when we were convening this panel, some of my colleagues for other pieces on NPR and on KOW reaching out to Black voices in Seattle, prominent Black voices, you know, the reaction from a couple of people was not interested in talking to KOW anymore. You know, NPR is not here for the community. It hasn't done enough to follow through on its commitment to covering racial justice. And I'm curious to hear from you, and maybe we can start with Dr. Patricia Hunter. I'm curious to hear, when you get asked to do a panel like this, is your first reaction one of, you know, this is more of just the same? The media is disingenuous in covering these issues. How do you feel when you get invited to talk about this?
Well, thanks for asking that question. I'm a sustaining member for KUOW, and you get my money every month.
Thank you for that.
You're welcome. You're welcome. I believe in National Public Radio. So I was happy to be a part of this panel, even though speaking with media is not, you know, really high on my list of things to do, but because it's KUOW, I said yes.
Well, that's really very kind of you to say. I did not know that you were a sustaining member when I asked you that, Dr. Hunter, to be clear. Representative Kirsten Harris-Talley, same question to you. What's your reaction on issues like this? And do you feel like there is a sense that the media has fallen short and maybe, you know, public radio has fallen short?
I think all media has a moment right now to really sit with a reflection on what is being covered by whom. What do our newsrooms look like? Do they look like the communities impacted or not? And then are the folks who do look like the diversity of our communities the ones given the authority to have the consideration of the angle on the story and what is really at the heart of the conversation elevated? And I say that for all media, but I particularly say that for media that has public resources, because that adds a mission-driven onus for media to really reflect what the priorities of community are. Generally, I don't think anyone is covering in depth really with the consistency that we need, mm-hmm. what it is to really deeply scrutinize state systems that can be abusive, are abusive, and need to have accountability. So I would call on all media to add the resources and infrastructure needed to have that consistency, because for policy change, for community movement building to have traction, there has to be visibility and people knowing what's happening. And that's what mission-driven media should do and does well, when they pay attention to what community is saying needs to be paid attention to.
Nikita Oliver, final thoughts on this conversation as we wrap up here. Anything you want to add on that or what else has been said today?
Thank you for asking this question. As a queer, Black, non-binary abolitionist who's ran for office, I have an extreme level of discomfort with the media. Not because media is doing their job, which I think is to truth tell, really hold to journalistic integrity, push our institutions to also be a part of truth-telling and actually do what is equitable and expose where it's not, but because I've actually experienced so much media using things that are inflammatory to get clicks or to get people to listen. And in some instances, there are institutions of media that are more committed to wealthy and white communities co-signing what they put out than they are to telling the truth. And so I do think twice before I do interviews, especially now, because I have not experienced fully the truth telling. What I will say about KUOW is I have been in moments of accountability with you all and seeing an attempt to do better, to put new standards in place, to hire journalists and reporters who have analysis and are willing to push the envelope on asking those hard questions of large, powerful institutions. And so that's why I'm more likely to engage with you all. But I do have a sense of discomfort that I think is rooted in an oppressive experience. But I also have a hope, because I've seen you all and some other institutions group, you know, push to do better. And I'm excited to see media like Converge Media and the South Seattle Emerald growing a platform that has the capacity to be able to speak truthfully on stories of communities that have been historically and presently marginalized in a way that actually honors where those experiences come from.
That's Nikita Oliver. They're a Seattle-based community organizer, artist, abolitionist, and attorney. You also heard from Representative Kirsten Harris-Talley of the 37th District in the State House and Dr. Patricia Hunter, who is the pastor for outreach and education at Seattle First Baptist Church and interim pastor for worship at Mount Zion Baptist Church. I appreciate you all today for joining us. And, you know, despite your range of feelings about the way these conversations are convened and the way that we are doing our job in the media, I appreciate you all. And thank you for sharing your time and your energy with us today.